I've made made a number of hospital visits over the past 20 years or so in ministry. Not nearly as many as somebody in that with that number of years of ministry in a different church setting, but still quite a bit. And this is one of my favorite psalms to read to somebody who is, you know, somebody who's sick, somebody who's hurting, somebody who is dying, somebody who is just really, really struggling with whatever the circumstances God has allowed in their lives. And you can see just from hearing when we read it why that is. Now, King David wrote the psalm, and he describes in the first part of it, it's interesting the way, the order of how it goes, because it seems like it's kind of mixed up. It's like he has the good news and then the bad news and then the good news again. But in the first part, he's describing how God delivered him from a terrible crisis of life and faith. In the second part, he sort of revisits that crisis. He remembers what it was like. And so that's why his statements seem to kind of go backwards. But then in the third part, he's making a vow. He's making good on a vow. So probably he wrote this, and then he was reading this or singing it in the presence of the people, you know, at the temple. And so he's saying, okay, I made this promise to God when I was in the middle of this crisis, and I want you all to know that I'm making good on it. That this is not just something that I threw out in the middle of the storm, like Martin Luther when when he was in the middle of this lightning storm and thought he was going to die and said, Lord, help me, I'll become a monk. And then he realized, oh, dear God, I have to do this now. And he did. So in a real way, this psalm is a testimony of David to God's goodness in his life. And so, as you remember, we've been going throughout Advent and Christmas, we're talking about the fruit of the Spirit: love, joy, peace, patience, kindness. So all of these, we've been looking at, how is God love? How is God peace? How is God joy, patience, kindness? How does he reflect these? We get a better idea of how we're to reflect them if we see how God embodies them first. And so in this psalm, David's just saying, listen, God, you are good. And I want to tell you specifically how you've been good. So this will help us to see how our goodness flows out of his. So three quick things I want to show you in this. And the first is God's goodness in our past. So the word that David uses for return, he says there in verse 7, return, O Lord. This is a Hebrew word that it connotes kind of repentance. It's a word that the angel used with Hagar. You remember Hagar was Sarah, Abraham and Sarah's servant, and Sarah had mistreated her. Hagar had run away, and the angel came to her and was very, very gracious, very kind, very gentle. Said, "Listen, God has great plans for you. He's gonna form a nation out of your this child that you've had." And of course, there's a lot of conflict associated with that. But God gave specific promises to Hagar, even though she was not, you know, she was not the one that would bring the promised child. That was Sarah and Isaac. But the angel does say, "Return to Sarah," and there's this sense of, you know, you don't belong here out in the wilderness. You need to go back. You need to submit yourself. And so there is this sense of repentance. So there may be, I think there's a sense of conviction of sin that David's feeling here, because his heart's wandered away from God, and he remembered what God had done for him. And so he says, return to your rest, literally resting place, because God's been good. And he mentions three kinds of deliverance there in verse 8. He says, you delivered my life from death. You've delivered my eyes from tears. You've delivered my feet from stumbling. So in a sense, you could say God's restored his physical life, you know, preserved his life. He restored his emotional state, and he preserved the course of his life, the pathway of his life. Now you think about it, that about covers it, right? it pretty much covers the breadth of our experiences. And in David's life, when you think about that, okay, how did David's life get delivered from death? How did he get delivered from tears? How did he, you know, the way of his life get preserved? Well, the only thing that makes sense in David's life is to go back to when he was running from King Saul. And, you know, they're doing laps around mountains, running away from each other. And David is brokenhearted, crying out before God, trying to figure out. And this went on for years where he was running from Saul. And yet through that, God did. He preserved his life. He restored David when he was broken. and he preserved the course of his life. He had a plan for David to become king through all of that. So all three of those things were at risk. His life, his heart, you could say, and his pathway. And God brought him through them all. Even though in the middle of it, it didn't look like it. It didn't all happen very neatly and cleanly. And it doesn't happen for us either that way, does it? When you're in the middle of it, in the middle of some kind of terrible crisis, it doesn't feel like God is there. You don't see how God is going to work it all out. And yet, on the other side of it, he does. There's a story about an old bishop named Babylas, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, from the 3rd century. He was, I believe, imprisoned during the Decian persecution, later died. But during his imprisonment, he was said to have quoted verses 7 through 9 of Psalm 116 because it was a reminder of the hope of eternal life. You know, he was saying here, "You, Lord, have delivered my soul from death, my eyes from tears, my feet from stumbling. I will walk before the Lord in the land of the living." And there is a sense in which we can look at the land of the living as heaven. This is a place where we're going to be living eternally. But David probably did not mean it that way. He probably meant it to refer to his life on earth. Because he had been going through this time of the years of running from Saul was, in a sense, like a hell on earth. It was like almost like a separation from God. And yet God restored him. And he held on to this hope that God was going to, you know, God was going to bring him through, and he did. And so this is where probably later he's remembering that. So we're going to look a little more in a few minutes how he was going to do that. But I want to encourage you, just as we're standing here at the end of the year, at the cusp of a new year, and I think it's a good time to reflect on how God has done that in our lives. Maybe God has literally delivered you from death. Some of you he has, maybe not this year. Some of you know people that you're very close to, that he has delivered from death. But some of you also know those that are very, very dear to you that he has not delivered from death. He has allowed to die, to go to heaven. Maybe he's delivered you from a crushing experience in the past year. One of the reasons that we celebrate Christmas as more than just a day is that it gives us more chances to thank God for his goodness, for the incarnation, for the resurrection, for everything that he's done. So I want to encourage you, don't gloss over those Ebenezers, those stones of remembrance that the Israelites, when they were crossing the Jordan River in the Old Testament, they set up these piles of stones. And, you know, you see them if you climb Mount Washington, if you climb Mount Monadnock, you see these piles of stones. A great reminder of how God, he does that in your life. He gives you certain tangible things that you can look back to. And a lot of times it's good to actually come up with something that you can look at, that you can stick on your mantle and say, "I remember that God brought me through this really crushing experience. And every time I look at this, it reminds me." So don't forget. That's why throughout the Bible, Old and New Testament, over and over and over, God calls us, remember, remember, remember. So the second thing I want you to see here is God's goodness in our suffering. So look at verses 10 and 11. He says, "I believed even when I spoke. I'm greatly afflicted. I said in my alarm, all mankind are liars." So here, David's remembering how he went through crisis, and he's giving both sides of how he dealt with it. So you have his faith on one side, and then you have, in a sense, his fear or his frustration when he's actually going through it. And this is what our experience is like, isn't it? When you go through crisis, you believe on the one hand, but then you're constantly going back and forth with the agony of what it's actually like to experience it. And yet the faith is that foundation underneath that actually brings you through. So David's faith drove him to verbalize to God what he was experiencing rather than giving up. And he was brutally honest. The word that he uses for afflicted means crushed. At the same time, the pain of what he's going through caused him to see other people in his life not as clearly as he might, you know, otherwise have done it. And again, haven't you experienced this? You're going through a really terrible, painful experience, and you lash out at people that you love. You accuse people. You do things that you wouldn't otherwise do because you're not seeing things completely clearly. And in this psalm, David says, in my haste, in my dismay, some translations say, in my haste, I said, all men are liars. So in other words, he looks at the way King Saul is treating him, which is very deceitful. You remember King Saul, at different times, David, of course, twice has the opportunity to kill Saul. And Saul is very repentant, and he's weeping. And, oh, David, my son, oh, I love you, I love you, I love you. And then the next thing you know, wow, the spear comes out. So Saul was extremely deceitful, and this colored the way David viewed all kinds of people. He didn't know who he could trust. And by the way, this isn't only about the time when David was running away from Saul. You remember his son Absalom did the same thing. His son Absalom came back, you know, won the hearts of the people over. David ends up being driven out of his palace, and this is later in his life, later in his reign. David did not lead a charmed and cushy life. He had a lot of real crisis. But I love what Derek Kidner said about these verses. He said, to feel crushed or disillusioned, to say so, even in the wild tones of panic, is no proof that faith is dead. It may even vouch for its survival, as pain betokens life. What does that mean to you? That pain betokens life. Pain is actually, pain is what C.S. Lewis said, it's God's megaphone to a sleeping world. Pain is necessary to the living out of our faith. The hymn writer H.F. Light said, when other helpers fail and comforts flee, help of the helpless, oh, abide with me. You felt like that? Have you felt like that this year? You felt like that all of your helpers failed and all of your comforts had fled, that God is the only one that you had? That's how David felt. It feels normal for us, I think, to lash out at God when we don't see him answer right away. We don't see. It doesn't seem like he's there. It feels like he's abandoned us. And I think for a lot of people, just in general, in our American society, because we want things bang to happen so quickly, we think, okay, that's evidence that God isn't there. What's wrong? You know, here's a Christian who's going through a hard time. Where is God in this? You know, this is supposedly evidence that God isn't real, that he really doesn't care. And if he even exists at all. But I like what John Calvin said about this psalm. He said, if the faithful regain their peace of mind only when God manifests himself as their deliverer, what room is there for the exercise of faith? In other words, if we only experience peace and rest when God fixes our problems, why in the world do we need faith in the first place? What is faith? What does Hebrews 11 say? It is the evidence of things, what? Not seen. Not delivered, not healed, not received. It's the evidence of things that don't get fixed. Maybe they get fixed way, way down the road. Maybe they don't at all. But being Christians means that we live in a gap. We live where we don't get everything that we want. We don't see everything resolved. That is the essence of the Christian life. And our American culture distorts that view. We don't see it clearly. We want everything to get fixed, at least within a 52 and a half minute episode, right? I mean, that's when it's supposed to happen, and it doesn't. So David here not only recalls his faith in crisis, but his frustration and his impatience, and we're in the same boat. Now, here's what we need to remember. One of the big reasons, again, that we're celebrating Christmas for 12 days, we remember that God understands. We're celebrating Christmas because it gives us more time than simply 24 hours to reflect how Jesus, not how Jesus became Christ. I remember watching this PBS documentary it was how Jesus, from Jesus to Christ, the first Christians. This was the idea that the early church had basically created this idea that Jesus was divine. And he was really just a regular guy, and they created this aura, this persona. And it's hard to watch. If you're a serious Christian, it's hard to watch. It's because these very erudite and scholarly people who have devoted their lives to studying a book that they don't believe. And I don't know how they can get up in the morning. But anyway, what we celebrate at Christmas is not how Jesus became Christ, but how Christ became Jesus. How the anointed king became a human being. And I read a striking statement in a great devotional that Chris McMillan gave me. It says this: at the heart of the Christmas season is the mystery of the incarnation, of God becoming human. The Christian faith is at the same time both wonderfully material and mystical, having no truck with escapist spirituality. We don't usually use truck in that way, I know. A truck is usually something that has a big space in the back and four-wheel drive. But what it's saying is that we care about the material. We care about people's bodies. We care about the earth. We don't just take off to heaven. You know, Sam is going to live his life as a believer in this world, in a physical body, with other people with physical bodies. We care about the material because God cares about the material, because he sent his son to become a human being. The Christmas season grounds our faith in space and time. A world that's broken, this body that bleeds, materiality is not an embarrassment to God. He created it, and he revels in it. See, what that tells us is that God understands suffering. He feels our pain because he felt our pain. The other day, I heard about a short film. Allie was showing me a video clip that somebody that commented on her blog had embedded this in the comment, and I was doing a little hunting around about it. It turned out that there was a short film. It's about 30 minutes long that was written that came out in 2003, and it's actually originally from the Czech Republic, and it's called Most, and it was renamed, I believe the English title, or it was renamed at some point The Bridge. And you'll recognize the story. It's probably, you know, it's an illustration that many of us have heard for many years. But it was beautifully created in this movie. I haven't seen the whole thing. I've seen sort of a couple different synopses or trailers. But it's about a father who worked as a train engineer at a drawbridge over a river. And he had a son who was 9 or 10 years old, who he loved dearly, who grew up around the tracks and knew them very, very well, and understood his father's job and understood the dangers and the risks of his father's job. And the father taught his son very carefully about the dangers of the bridge and about the gear works that move the bridge up so that ships could pass safely, and down so that trains could pass over. And one day the son was playing near the water, and he saw that a train was coming an hour ahead of schedule. And the drawbridge was up so that a ship could be passing. And he realized that the train was going to hit the bridge, and those people in the train were going to die unless he could do something about it. And at that point, his father had not seen this train coming from the perspective where he was at. And so he ran to the bridge to help alert his father to the coming train when he tripped and fell into the gear works of the bridge. And he could not get out. Now, he was fine as long as the bridge was not lowered. But his father, by that point, saw the train and realized what had happened to his son and realized what was going to happen to those people. He had to make this incredibly painful choice that I hope none of us ever have to make, between the life of his son and the lives of the people on this train. And so he only had a split second to do it, and so he did. He lowered the drawbridge, crushing his son in the gearworks of the bridge. And those people, as they passed over this bridge, were completely oblivious. You know, they saw this engineer just screaming and crying. They had no idea why. Most of them weren't even looking out the window. They were just doing their thing, just going through just on the train. Had no idea what the cost was for this particular trip over this particular bridge that particular day. Except there was one young woman who had traveled that train before and who knew the little boy and knew the engineer. And she was a heroin addict. She was actually trying to take a hit in that moment in that train that day when she looked out the window and she realized, seeing the Father's face, she realized what had happened. And in that instant, her life changed. And the powerful thing, I still have to actually see the movie and get it, so I'll tell you about it in detail, but later. But that day, her life changed forever. And she was no longer a heroin addict. She got into a healthy relationship, had a child. She restored contact with this engineer a couple of years later and showed him this child. That in a sense, that in a very real sense, his sacrifice of losing his son was not in vain. That it had resulted in her life being changed, and really, in a real way, this new life and this new hope because of his sacrifice. It's a beautiful parable of the gospel, of what God has done in us. That his son's life was not purposeless. It was not a waste. And that's the reason that we can know that your pain is not in vain, because his pain was not in vain. God understands suffering. And he understands suffering has a purpose, even for us. Right, the last thing I want you to see here is God's goodness in our response. So David, recalling God's goodness, says, "What shall I render to the Lord for all his benefits to me? I will lift up the cup of salvation and call upon the name of the Lord. I will pay my vows to the Lord in the presence of all his people." In ancient Israelite worship, there was a peace offering where the head of a family would give thanks to God for his deliverance of the people of Israel from slavery in Egypt. And he would hold up a cup of wine, and it was referred to as the cup of salvation. Now, it's kind of a rhetorical question, right? There's nothing that we can do to repay the Lord for all of his kindness and his goodness to us. All we can do is to give thanks. And the metaphor of the cup, though, is very, very important. Because Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, if you remember, begged his Father. He said, "Let this cup pass from me." It was understanding deep in the heart of Israelite worship that there was a cup. The Passover meal involved taking the cup of salvation. But that's because there was also a cup of wrath. And what the scripture tells us is that Jesus drank the cup of God's wrath, of his anger at sin, even though he never sinned. So when we are at the Lord's table and stand for the first time today, when we raise the cup of wine, we raise the cup of salvation, remembering that Jesus drank the cup of wrath for us. God's suffering had a purpose in our salvation. Now, the other thing that David does is just as striking. He says, "I will pay my vows in the presence of all his people." David, we don't know exactly what the vow was, but he made some kind of a vow during his time of trouble. Maybe it was to bring a gift. Maybe it was to offer a sacrifice. Maybe it was to make some kind of a serious commitment. And he was determined to make it good. And so he went before the people that day, and he kept his word to God. He paid his vow. And this is a really fascinating picture of what happened here today. You see, a lot of people say they believe in God. And a lot of people say they love Jesus. But we live in a commitment-averse society. We don't like to make commitments. We don't like to sign our name on the dotted line. You know, you talk to a lot of young women who are waiting for some guy to stop dragging his feet and make a commitment to marriage. Our society is very commitment-averse, and this happens in the church, too. We have a lot of people who want to love Jesus. They don't want to take a vow to him in front of other people. And the scriptures call us to act on our internal belief with an external commitment. And Sam has taken that step today. As a believer in Jesus Christ, he's going to be admitted to the sacrament.